Let me ask you a question. How likely on a scale from 1 to 10 do you think nuclear holocaust is in the next 10 years?
I mean, I have to believe it's low simply because of mutually assured destruction, and that ultimately people's desire, no matter how ideologically possessed, will ultimately boil down, hopefully, to not going that direction.
Like 2 or?
Yeah, I'd say 5%, 2%, you know, something real but low.
Yeah. So.
And I pray to God I'm right.
Yeah, well, in my case, that wouldn't help anything, but okay.
I don't really believe in God either, but I'm going to still do it.
Okay. So you think there's a low chance, and you think that our foreign policy excursions increase the likelihood of those of that occurrence?
100%.
Welcome to Conversations with Peter Boghossian. I just had one of my all-time favorite conversations with Clint Russell. He's a former entrepreneur turned politician for the Libertarian Party, super smart guy, super interesting conversation. I hope you enjoy. Clint, welcome to Conversations with Peter Boghossian. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Peter.
I appreciate it.
Big fan of your work.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate that. So this is the first time in my life, I'm 57. This is the first time in my life that people have told me unequivocally they are disgusted by a Trump-Biden runoff. Disgusted was the word that people have used, and they will vote. Not they're thinking about voting, but they will vote for a third party. Now, you are running for the VP of the Libertarian Party.
I am.
Do the Libertarians have any chance of gaining the presidency of the United States?
In this upcoming election, no.
Okay.
I'll be honest. But I think you're right. I think that we are at an inflection point where more and more people are disturbed by the binary option that they're presented with, and more people are looking for third options. I think RFK Jr. is probably the most viable third party candidate since Ross Perot. More than likely he will just serve as a spoiler for one or the other of the candidates, but he's an interesting figure. I think that, you know, his willingness to talk about kind of third rail topics when it comes to the CIA, FBI, what happened to his family, the COVID era. I'm very appreciative that he's broadened the Overton window.
Okay. So if the Libertarians don't have any real chance, would you say like they have to have some like a 0.1% or 1% chance? Or
I would say very, very low.
Okay.
Just so, because people perceive the election as a winner take all, because it is, and they don't want to waste their vote. So until you have a candidate that runs as a third party that receives 12, 15, 20% and makes it so that people perceive in the next election that, well, a third party actually can win. I think that's what our opportunity is this go around, is to prove that a third party can win, not that we will.
Okay. So explain something to me, because I literally just learned about this 5 minutes ago. So how does the Libertarian Party nominate or elect, or what would the – explain the process by which someone becomes a VP?
Sure. This is very unique. This is the only party I'm familiar with that actually does it this way. But at the end of May, so next month, there will be about 1,000 delegates from all over the country that are Libertarian Party members that are selected by their state chapters to become a formal delegate, fly to D.C. and cast a vote, not just for the president, but also for the vice president. So in the Libertarian Party, the presidential nominee will not be able to select the vice presidential candidate. So theoretically, if the rumors are true that RFK Jr. is in fact going to seek our nomination for the presidency because he can't get ballot access as an independent, theoretically, I could be paired with RFK Jr., and that would be a clash of civilizations, but it would be interesting.
So what is the point in doing – why – what's the idea behind that?
Well, I guess it's leaning in toward – into democratic processes and allowing the delegates to select both, so that if you don't get who you'd want to be the presidential nomination, which in many cases would be RFK, well, then the hardcore Ron Paulians could have somebody like me.
But I guess I'm still a little fuzzy, but – okay,
so I don't know like the origin story for how that process began.
No. I'm just trying to think through, not the origin story, not historically, but it doesn't seem to make sense to me. What if and I'm not saying this is the case, forget RFK. What if somebody who has the nomination and then you're the VP, what if you two hate each other?
Yeah, that would be a problem. I think it'd be interesting, though.
But I mean, yeah, go ahead.
I mean, that's part of politics. You're going to have to interact with people. You're going to have to reach across the aisle, as they say. So we would have to do it in our own party. In fact, we do have to do it in our own party. We've had this terrible fight within the Libertarian Party over the past few years. What's called the Mises Caucus, which I'm a member of, took over the Libertarian Party about 2 years ago. And that was kind of a reemergence of the Ron Paul wing of libertarianism in contrast to the more progressive wing, which had taken over the party. So we've been at each other's throats for quite some time now. So this is kind of just a continuation of that process.
Okay. So slow down, please, sure. If you don't mind. The Mises wing, and I assume you're going to go from there to Hayek, the Mises wing to the Ron Paul, flesh that out for me.
Sure. The Mises Caucus is just the name that was taken on, but it really what it represented, and that's named after Ludwig von Mises, which I'm sure you've heard of, but it really what it was just a re-embrace of the Ron Paul. Ron Paul was really what got me involved in the Libertarian Party and in politics broadly. Many people that are involved in the Libertarian Party came because of Ron Paul. After his foray into politics and running as the GOP candidate for the presidency in 2008 and 2012, many of the Ron Paul libertarians left the Libertarian Party.
Why?
Because he was in the GOP. So we wanted to support him.
I see.
So because of that, in that void or in that vacuum, many of the more progressive people, those that are convinced of many of the progressive narratives when it comes to racism being a huge issue and things like that in America, they kind of took the power structure over. So
that would seem to be anti-libertarian to me.
It is to me as well.
Unless I'm not thinking clearly through it. So let's talk about why it's anti-libertarian to you.
Sure.
So why is that anti-libertarian? First, what's a libertarian, and then why is that anti-libertarian to you?
To me, a libertarian is someone that believes in property rights first and foremost, is interested in peace and prosperity, non-intervention.
Foreign intervention, foreign wars, like neocon.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Or neoprogressives, because they do the same stuff.
Yeah.
And ultimately, we value the individual. So we're quite in opposition to collectivism. And I think that's why, you know, focusing on racism, sexism, homophobia, all these things that the more progressive wing seems to be obsessed with is kind of counterintuitive, just simply because as individualists, we already perceive racism to be an absurdity, because you're judging someone based off of mutable characteristics as opposed to like the content of their character, like who they actually are, their merits, their skill set, things like that. So it goes without saying that the Mises Caucus, Ron Paulian wing of the Libertarian Party would also not be racist, but it is a lie to believe that America is one that is, you know, rife with racism and sexism and homophobia. So this is why we think that the focus on it is misplaced.
Okay. So I'm going to throw this out, and if my thinking is an error, you tell me. My reasoning is an error. If one accepts core tenets of libertarianism, and I'll throw out what I think some of those core tenets are. Markets good. The freer the markets, the better. Laissez-faire economics, a la Adam Smith.
Yep.
Private property rights, as you said. Socially liberal, in other words, let people do anything they want. I know the word liberal is fraught with interpretive danger. Economically, laissez-faire. How would progressivism, and I define that in the context of this conversation as, I'm trying to frame it neutrally. I was going to say preoccupation with identitarian concerns, but I'm trying to frame it neutrally. How would forwarding identitarian concerns of race, gender, trans status, et cetera, how would that comport with a libertarian ethos of markets will fix everything? And I'm not saying one has to agree that markets will fix everything. I'm saying, like, if that is the starting assumption, how does I can't even square that circle.
Well, I struggle with it as well. I think it's misplaced. And I don't think, I mean, there has been a divide in libertarianism for, you know, a generation, in that oftentimes we will be divided on the civil rights movement, for instance, in that forcing integration is counter to, you know, the voluntary association of people, which libertarians strongly believe in. So while we do not believe in forced segregation either, but integration should also not be forced. So that is kind of the moderate position that, yes, we would believe, the more Ron Paulian wing of the libertarians would believe that ultimately racism, sexism, all these things would be diminished through the free market process of, well, are you going to have this restaurant that allows for right. black customers? Well, you'll probably eat the lunch of the racist, you know, diner down the street.
Okay. So I think it behooves us to explain the reasoning behind that, the mechanism. And sure. let me tell you what I think the mechanism behind that is, and you tell me if that is how you view it. Mm-hmm. The idea is that market forces will correct for any exogenous, endemic, or endogenous injustices within the system. For example, if a bunch of people hate Samoans or black people or midgets or whatever they hate, whoever they have, they're harboring animus towards some group. The market mechanism will overcome that because the profit motive will trump people's desire to seek profit will trump any base rank bias that they have. Is that the basic idea?
Yeah. I mean, it's not inevitable.
Yeah.
Certainly there are you know, civilizations or cultures where racism might be lucrative. I just don't think that that's what America is. I think we've proven that at the end of the day, what brings us together, for instance, yeah. you can have a hardcore Israel supporter
yeah.
get into a cab with a hardcore, you know, Hamas supporter.
Yeah.
And they don't clash with one another. They exchange services and money, and they, at the end of it, they just get out of the cab. And it's like, these are opportunities for peaceful integration as opposed to forced integration.
Okay. So if we lived in a society in which a cultural value in that society, and I'm trying not to situate this in terms of religious context, so let's keep it in an American race, sure. racial context. If we live in a society that treated, I don't know, indigenous population, what have you, just like dirt, and it was lucrative for that
to persist.
To persist in perpetuity, independent of the profit motive of markets, wouldn't that undermine the main libertarian thesis?
Well, if you buy the premise that the state would be able to remedy it properly, or that it wouldn't create secondary effects that are actually more deleterious than the existing concerns. And I think that's what libertarians are very good is identifying that turning towards the state always has secondary effects. And oftentimes people don't focus on that at all.
Okay. So I'm trying to think through this myself. So would that mean there's both a universal in libertarianism and a non-universal? The universal would be in no society, in no country, in no, you know, period in history ought people to turn toward the state to solve their problems. Can we say that's a universal?
I wouldn't say it's a universal simply because I'm not a globalist. And I think that from my vantage point, there are cultures and people and civilizations that do not desire to be libertarian or live in a libertarian framework. And I'm not interested in foisting that upon them. But I think it is a universal in the sense that all libertarians would agree. Well, I can't even say that because some libertarians would obviously disagree with me. But I think most libertarians would agree with the premise that you should not turn towards the state to remedy close to anything.
Okay. So let's go back to what you said. So is it a universal that libertarianism will lead to human flourishing?
I believe so.
Okay. So if it's a universal that libertarianism will lead to human flourishing, then any society that doesn't elect or adopt those libertarian principles, it would be fair for an independent person outside the system to say that that's wrong.
Yeah, I think so. Okay. I mean, we're not forbidden from casting judgment. It's just that because we believe in the non-aggression principle, we would not aggress upon them to remedy what we think they're doing wrong.
Right. So that's consistent then. You can consistently have that, so you can maintain the ability to criticize without some kind of neocon adventure.
Exactly.
Without going off and imposing any system on people.
Exactly. So we can still – we can be critical of the foreign policy of the CCP or the IDF or Hamas or anybody.
Yeah.
But that is not to be taken or extrapolated towards advocacy for the U.S. State Department or the military-industrial complex to ramp up to go and deal with that issue.
Yeah.
At least – that's how I – when I speak out against those things, I am never once am I going to the extent of saying I want the government to actually go and address this.
When you say those things, what do you mean?
Well, like the – we talked on the show last night about the CCP with the Uyghurs, right?
Yeah, Luke Radowski's.
Yeah, Luke Radowski, the Best Political Show. And so that would be an example of – I mean there's horrific things happening all over the world all the time. And I am never – going to advocate for the U.S. government. And we actually discussed this as well.
Yeah, we disagreed on this.
Yes. Not because I think that there's never a moment where intervention is necessary, but rather I don't believe that you can maintain the foundational principles that make America so special while also being the world's police.
Yeah, and our disagreement, I'm largely in agreement with that. I think we talk about Kissinger a bit if you want. He had an interesting principle about China, Russia, the United States balancing each other. So we're largely in agreement. I think where our disagreement came last night is in cases of genocide. Right. And not all cases of genocide, like the Uyghurs, because this really – what are you going to do? Right? I mean there are practical concerns there as well.
1.4 billion people in nuclear weapons. Good luck.
Yeah. And I think I mentioned last night when I read Clinton's autobiography that he said that, not going into Rwanda was the biggest mistake of his presidency.
Right. Yeah. And this is oftentimes also there will be this kind of misunderstanding about libertarians in that just because we're not advocating for the state to intervene doesn't mean that we would forbid
want genocide.
Well, we want genocide or that we would forbid private parties from voluntarily intervening. Or like libertarians oftentimes will like run aid caravans to the Cubans while they are under communism, things like that. There's also libertarians that will enter into the Foreign Legion and they will go fight on behalf of, you know, countries. So there's nothing that forbids a libertarian from actually risking themselves if they believe in a just cause. What it strictly says, as far as I'm concerned, is that turning to the state and having them have the capacity to conscript others that aren't interested in doing what you believe in. To tax those.
Someone else's kids.
Yeah, to take someone else's kids and put them in harm's way, to steal money from me, to buy bombs for a war that I may or may not believe in, because we function under a democratic system. I think that's where we get, you know, really out of line.
Okay, so in a libertarian framework, would the state have any role to prevent someone to going, like say a kid who was, the day after his 18th birthday, he wanted to go through to Syria to fight for ISIS?
That's an interesting one. I mean, it would be a real question as to whether or not you'd want to let them back in.
So they're free to go, but they don't get back. They can't come back.
Yeah, well,
it's happening in London now. This is really interesting.
No, I know. And I think there are also examples of Americans that have gone and done similar things. So it's not a total hypothetical.
John Walker Lind went to the F. Yeah.
Yeah, so this is actually a good opportunity for me to talk about another divide amongst libertarians.
Yeah, please.
In that there are hard open borders libertarians and those that do not believe in that. I am not an open borders libertarian.
I completely don't understand that, so maybe you can explain it to me. I'm utterly baffled by it.
You don't understand the open borders or the closed argument? Which one?
I cannot for the life of me understand why someone would not want to secure a southern border.
Yeah, well... I agree with you. I agree with you.
I mean, I don't even understand the argument behind it.
Well, I'll try and steel man it, even though I disagree with
it.
The steel man is that, you know, you build a wall to keep people out.
Yeah.
A tyrannical state will use that wall to keep you in. They also argue that, you know, people have a right to move peaceably, you know, if you're a peaceful person. The issue...
Okay, I'm sorry. Can I pause you? If you're a peaceful person, that... by necessity means there are no open borders.
Explain.
Well, you'd have to vet people.
Exactly. That was going to be my next follow-up point.
Oh, okay.
Is that particularly because of the empire building that we've been doing for the past – my entire life, you have created tremendous animosity towards America and Americans for a long time. I am not at all interested in being an empire with an open borders. We've seen many empires, you know, meet their demise with that type of, in my opinion, really misguided thinking. So I think that there is way too much. If we had been kind of a Switzerland-esque nation, perhaps we wouldn't have to worry so much about immigration or dangerous people coming across the border. But the reality is that we do. Also, from a libertarian framework, we would be legalizing all drugs. So the cartel issues would be diminished quite extensively. But as it stands today with the war on drugs, you have really dangerous, really armed people that are involved not just in trafficking drugs, but also in trafficking people. So I think these are all issues that kind of clash with an open borders framework.
Okay. So I'm really trying to understand what the reasoning is here, and I'm failing. What is the thinking behind – is it – so they want open borders.
They do.
And they just want anybody to be able to come in – pedophiles, murderers, rapists, well, maniacs, this, lunatics.
Yeah. This is an interesting thing that they always do. They always say peaceful people have a right to, you know, move freely. And the obvious counter, which no one ever seems to approach them with, is how do you know they're peaceful? And you don't. You can't know if you don't have a vetting process. So there are some in the open borders crowd that'll be like Ellis Island-esque, where they will have some stopping point where they have to have some, you know, very basic background check to see if they have any violent criminal history. But there are others that just strongly believe, you know, they're the more anarchist leaning. And I consider myself an anarcho-capitalist, but I also, as an anarcho-capitalist, yeah, I believe in property rights. And I think that the issue that we run into is that because the federal government has deemed itself the owner of so much of the public lands,
yeah,
which is anathema in a libertarian society, you would not have public property because you would not have a state that would be owning public land. Everything would be privatized.
Yeah.
So in a private property system, you would never permit anybody to come across your land. You would always have some sort of vetting process because, you know, any private property owner, you don't let anybody come into your home, right?
Okay, let's rewind that a second.
I just said a lot, sorry.
No. You're good. Because I'm trying to think through this stuff myself. So how do you define anarcho-capitalist?
Well, anarcho-capitalism, you know, Rothbard was kind of the progenitor of that wing of our movement. You know, it's just really a focus on property rights. I think that Hans Hermann Hoppe is also kind of – he was a protege of Rothbard.
I don't know that.
Yeah, Hoppe's – he's a very interesting character. And he was actually the one, I think, that made the most compelling argument against open borders, arguing from a private property framework in opposition to public lands or how do you deal with the status paradigm where we are not living in a libertarian utopia where everything is privatized? Do you have no answer for how public lands are supposed to be regulated? I mean, the homelessness and the drug addiction crisis that we've been experiencing over the past few years is really indicative of this quandary that, like, Well, libertarians do not believe in prosecuting peaceful people for drug use.
Yeah.
I also am not interested in living in a civilization that allows for homelessness to run rampant while drug use is done in public. I think that is totally self-defeating. And the libertarians that advocate on behalf of that paradigm, I think, are deluded, honestly.
Yeah. Schellenberger really turned me on to the idea that homeless camps are really open drug bazaars.
Yeah, they are. And I come from California. Yeah. So, you know, unfortunately, I witnessed this firsthand. I witnessed the degradation of my state, and it's not pretty.
Yeah. Under a libertarian framework, though, that would be allowed.
It would not.
It would not.
Well,
people can just hang out in the street and smoke meth or do fentanyl or whatever.
Well, see, this is exactly why I mentioned Hoppe earlier, is that because of the public property, you know, quandary that I was discussing with you, like, you have to have some prudent regulations that would be reflective of what a private property owner would do.
Oh, I see. And that manifests itself in the commons.
Yes, like exactly. Because otherwise you suffer the tragedy of the commons.
All right.
So that's what you see in San Francisco is the tragedy of the commons. That any private property owner would not allow for some heroin addict to just be strewn you know, across their you know, bathroom floor or whatever. But under the current status paradigm where it's quote unquote public property, well, some libertarians say you have to allow that because they're not hurting anybody. I totally disagree.
Okay. So just to back up, I think that comes from Garrett Harding's 1953 piece, The Tragedy of the Commons, but someone on the YouTube channel will check that. And the idea is that just to unpack this because I find this to be fascinating. I think bathrooms are great examples of the commons and how people treat their bathrooms. I take pictures of bathrooms all around the world and I post them on Instagram and people think it's a little weird. And it is a little weird. But I think how people treat the bathrooms will tell you about the how they treat the commons.
Right? Oh, that's interesting.
The bathrooms are the commons.
It's very reflective, yeah.
Yeah, it's very, in the United States, we treat our commons in general terribly in certain areas. Yep. Like my, okay. All right, I'm not going to go into tragic commons. Most people who watch the channel know it. Okay, so...
That goes to show the difference between men and women too, by the way.
Well, how so?
Just because like a public bathroom for a man is usually a cesspit and then women's bathrooms are usually not so much.
Yeah, I can't speak to that.
Well, I've snuck into a few female bathrooms when the men's line was too long, but you know.
I won't press you on that.
It seems like they're more clean. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. They're spotless in most of the places we go.
The public bathrooms?
Outside the country, spotless.
Yeah. Well, I think that's also reflective of kind of a cultural decay.
God, I couldn't possibly agree more.
Yeah.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I think just as I was talking about what I've experienced over the past 40 years of life living in California for 38 of it, you see the degradation. Like you see kind of civilization become unwound, and it's really – it's unbelievable to me.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
It is. Genuinely.
And you get, you might disagree, but you get Make America Great Again.
Of course.
I get that.
Totally.
Yeah.
It was a great pitch.
Yeah.
We had Roger Stone on the show the night before you.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm not sure that he coined it, but he certainly had, his thumb on the scale. I would like to see America Made Great Again too.
Yeah. So what do you think is responsible? Like we go to New York. Reed and I go everywhere around the world. We go to New York and people are jumping over the turnstiles.
Right.
Everywhere, constantly. I went to London and I never saw anybody jump over the turnstiles. I said to Andrew Doyle, I've never seen anybody jump the turnstiles. He's like, I've been living here 40 some odd years. I've never seen anybody. We treat the commons like crap.
Right.
What do you think is responsible for the degradation of society, and do you think libertarianism can help bring some of that back?
Undoubtedly.
Because I'm thinking libertarianism is part of – even though I have libertarian sympathies, I'm thinking libertarianism has contributed to that problem.
Yes, and I know many conservatives actually make that argument that our desire to see nonviolent drug offenders released, they think that is advocacy for the homelessness crisis in Portland or California, things like that. I totally disagree with that assessment, obviously. But just to get back to the original question as to how did this come to pass?
And the this in that sentence is, I think we both agree, people in the United States treat the commons in general, and it's certainly regional, terribly.
Yeah. But I think it's really indicative of establishment decay and also
– Oh, interesting.
Also, lack of respect for the institutions. And I think a big part of that is that if you're given a position of authority and power as the police or the judicial system has been, or the executive for that matter, and you behave in a way that's immoral, I think it fosters a lack of respect and a righteous lack of respect for these institutions. Why should immoral people rule over me? And I think that like when you see cops that abuse people, now granted it's relatively rare.
Yeah.
But if you are ever put in a position of not just moral authority, but also given essentially a green light, you have a monopoly on violence, as a policeman. Yeah. And you abuse that right, well then you're going to foster a community that absolutely despises you. And I think that once you have that process, it kind of all goes downhill from there, and people start to care less about the community. They start to care less about the commons. But from my vantage point, this is all downhill from the progressive era, and it's all downhill of the central banking disaster in 1913 because of inflation. People get tired of hearing libertarians talking about ending the Federal Reserve. I totally understand.
But let's make sure let's keep it on the commons. So before you go, so your explanation for why Americans treat the commons like crap, and I mean that literally, they're committing social justice in the commons, right? In other words, they're defecating the
commons.
Yes. Okay. So explain that to me. Why do you think that we've both seen in our lifetime, I'm 57, I'm older than you. Yeah, it's heartbreaking. What do you attribute that to?
Well, I think some of the things I already explained, but I think that it's also there's a real mental health issue in this country, like very, very significant. And I think it arises in large part from a pharmaceutical industry that has almost total dominion over our political establishment. Once you start to prescribe, you know, psychotropic medications to children, you're essentially dooming them to a treadmill of increasing doses and varieties of drugs.
Okay. Wouldn't that then be a problem with capitalism? Because there's a market mechanism to make money off of. So wouldn't that undermine the libertarian thesis?
No, I don't think that it is an issue with capitalism per se, because it's still a key aspect of libertarianism, which we haven't talked about at all, is personal responsibility. I mean, you have to have personal responsibility, and you have to also look out for your friends, your family. I think that the real reason that we've gotten into this current paradigm is because more and more we have turned towards the state to alleviate every issue, as opposed to saying, like, for instance, I've been very upset with the conservatives that have been advocating on behalf of this TikTok ban lately. You know, because they consistently have advocated for personal responsibility throughout my life. This is what I liked about conservatives, is that they would say stuff like that. For instance, they would always talk about gun rights, and they say it's a tool. It's you know, the person who uses it is the problem. It's the tool is not the problem. Yeah. Well, this is the tool. Well, how about you take, you know, dominion over your own household? Okay. Why are you not able to actually prevent your children from going on what you believe is the CCP spyware? You know, it's just bizarre to me.
Okay, so.
Sorry, that was a weird tangent.
No, you're fine. I just want to try to figure this out. So we were in Taiwan. Reed and I were in Taiwan for 5 weeks. Actually, he came a little later. But when we flew down, I was flabbergasted by how clean the place was. I mean, I just was just shocked. And there are no – I'm going to tell you this, and you're like, that's not true. I'm telling you this is true. There are virtually no trash bins anywhere. Literally anywhere. People carry around their trash with them, and they even have little bags and stuff where they recycle their trash and they carry it around with them.
That's interesting.
It's fascinating. And I remember I just marveled at this. And the first day we got there, we went to I wanted to get some sushi, and we're walking around the street, and I just can't believe there were no trash bins and we had a guide, a local guide. There are no trash bins and there's no trash. And those two things didn't meld together to me. Like, and then we saw a single tissue on the ground, and we stood over it and we looked at it, and we were just fascinated. I mean, our minds could not fathom it. Okay, so now going back to, so they treat their commons
very well. With respect,
yeah, with respect. That's a much better way to put it. Yeah, we don't in general. Certainly, it's worse in West Coast cities. What do you think the reason for that is? You think it's just I think we both agree it's a manifestation of a cultural rot, a kind of decay. What is causing the cultural decay? Is it decline? Is it the family? Is it lack of trust in institutions?
I think it's a lack of shared cultural framework. I think that largely the American people have been divided in a really intractable fashion. We are so unbelievably polar opposites on almost every issue.
Completely agree.
So I think that once you're in that situation, when you have a shared cultural framework, you're going to be respectful of the commons because you respect the people that are going to be using it after you.
Yeah.
If you don't respect the people that are going to be using it after you, maybe you won't.
A shared cultural framework. But wait, I thought diversity was our strength.
Well, yeah. I think you know, diversity does have its merits, undoubtedly, but I think that—
Give me one.
Well, diversity of thought.
I was going to say, like, diversity, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have— I was going to say beside, like, you know, various food restaurants. Okay, so we should probably define diversity, but are we over the commons thing? Can we move on from that?
Sure. Well, I would still like to explain why I think that the central banking era has degraded civilization more broadly.
Yeah.
Once you turn over, which by the way was a tenet of communism, which was a central bank, so we should have avoided that. We didn't. but once you turn over the money supply or money creation or regulation to a central bank, which by the way is more or less a private institution, which is unbelievable that, you know, you have—
Well, the chair of the Federal Reserve is nominated, right?
He's appointed, yeah. But
excuse me, the chair of the Federal Reserve is appointed
by the president.
By the president of the United States. And so it's not.
But he presides over the private banks that constitute the board of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah. But the president has no. I mean, the president's since as long as I can remember, have been screaming about the interest rates.
Yes. And allegedly, the head of the Fed has autonomy. And he does not have to take marching orders. For instance, Biden kind of made headlines yesterday saying that we will see an interest rate cut by the end of this year. And it's like, well, you're not supposed to know that or be able to say it or dictate it. So
I remember I really respected – I'm going to say this and get 5,000 comments, people hating me. I really respected Paul Volcker, you know, the former chair of the Federal
Reserve. Yes, me too.
Oh, you too, really?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, he did the impossible. Yeah. He hiked, you know, overnight lending rates to 20% in the early 80s. He created a massive deflationary bust that ultimately laid the groundwork for arguably the greatest economic boom in human history from 1980 to 2008.
I'm glad to hear you say that. Okay, yeah.
And this is coming from a libertarian. To say anything positive about a chairman of the Federal Reserve is, you know, I'll probably get some hate mail for that one too.
Yeah. So you want to do away with the Federal Reserve? So So what about monetary supply? What about interest rates? Oh, you think that they should all be subject to market mechanisms? And so like
I do.
You walk into bank X and they have their interest rate? And
yes, absolutely. I mean, that I can say this with some level of authority because I ran a private mortgage company that was I set the interest rates based off my investors' capital versus the borrower's demands. And you find an equilibrium.
Okay, so – well, how do we just determine how much money is in supply? Like, how do we determine the monetary supply?
Well, you don't determine the monetary supply. The market determines the value of whatever the exchange currency will be.
But you need to print some money.
Well, I mean, Bitcoin could theoretically replace the existing fiat system, which would be printing not at all.
Balaji's constantly talking about that. So this is a whole
rabbit
hole.
Yes, this is massive. But just to circle back, I really got to just explain the case against central banking, why the cultural decay is a byproduct of it. And also the entire century of total war is also a product of turning over to the printing press.
Oh, wow. That's going to be – wow. Okay. So explain that to me because draw that line for me.
Yeah. Well, as long as a government has to live within its means, it cannot have total war. I mean, the only reason that we were able to get away with lockdowns is because we have a central bank that's able to print trillions of dollars. The gravest violation of civil liberties in my lifetime, or freedom more broadly, was the lockdowns of 2020. There is no way the American people permit that or the federal government can actually do so if not for their access to the treasury, to the printing press, to borrowing, et cetera, et cetera. Like you have to be able to keep the system functioning. Okay. Without a central bank, you could not do so.
Okay, I'm going to push back on you.
Sure.
If that's fine. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so then explain to me why. So I read something a while ago that countries that are connected in financial networks, this is kind of like Tom Friedman's idea, theory of the golden arches, et cetera. Countries that are connected in financial networks are much less likely to require military interventions. Now, I know that you're against military interventions, et cetera, but the idea behind the United States is that we're not doing this out of some great humanitarian Pax Americana is not done out of some great humanitarian things, but securing waterways makes trade safe for everybody. Mm-hmm. And so the idea then would be that we have to print some money to enable our military to clear waterways so that we can promote international trade so that we can continue the capitalist machine.
That's an argument. I don't think it's true. I think that the capitalist machine persists regardless of the government because human beings still have a desire to trade goods.
But not without free trade internationally, it doesn't. And those regimes would then suffer economically because they couldn't trade, which would then make them more likely to fall into totalitarianism or warlords or what have you. And then they would require – it would be more likely that some military intervention would be required. I'm thinking like the Horn of Africa. I'm thinking like the Houthis and the Strait of Hormuz.
Yemen.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean –
Yemenis, yeah, that would be good.
Yeah, the Houthis are in Yemen, I believe. But it's not that there's no need for security. I mean, libertarians definitely believe in that. We're huge Second
International
Amendment.
International security I'm talking about.
Yeah, no, I understand. Oh, okay. I'm extrapolating from there. But private corporations still have a tremendous incentive to try and keep their goods safe as they traverse these dangerous waters. You would have, obviously private security forces that would be willing to fill that role.
Boy, okay. So bracketing the expense of that, maybe I'm too held hostage to the neoliberal order. Like, I'm sure you're probably
from my perspective.
That,
yes.
Yeah, I'm sure you're probably thinking that. Okay, but explain to me like in a practical sense, like how would that work?
Well, for instance, you have these multi-billion-dollar corporations that are going to be sending goods all over the world, right? Do you think that if the U.S. Navy were to stop defending them, that they would just go, all right, we're done? Like the answer is obviously that they would seek security for themselves. So there's this false belief that because the government handles this, that it cannot be handled by the private market, which if you actually look at any sort of government program, for the most part, it began being handled by private markets.
So just looking at the car industry.
So it can happen in reverse is the point.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm understanding this. So like just looking at the car market, like I can't remember 95%, if memory serves me correctly, of I think it's Ford's components are made outside the U.S. So you want like Ford to have its
own. Central banking, by the way.
Huh?
Product of central banking, by the way, but go ahead.
Okay, well bracket that for a second.
So I'm a libertarian. Want, like, I have to circle everything back to the central bank.
You want like Ford to have its own navy?
Well, it wouldn't necessarily be its own navy. It would probably be commissioned. They would hire them as they traverse the Strait of Hormuz or whatever.
Okay. And
for the record, this is not to say, like, I'm not interested in policing the entire world or dictating that these other countries can't use their government and their navy to make sure that goods as they traverse their waters are safe. If China wants to do so, they have that right. My entire argument is that the U.S. Navy has no business making sure that Exxon's goods from the Middle East are safe while they're traversing out of the Middle East. My argument would be, from our waters, you have that right. That's a minarchist libertarian argument. It's just that we should not be policing and socializing the cost of making a functioning economic system for the entire world. Why should the American taxpayer be held hostage to the security of every corporation on earth to make sure that the economic system continues to function? I think it's an absurdity. It's really an overt argument for socialism.
Okay.
With the American people on the hook to the benefit of the largest corporations in human history.
I'll make an argument. Because if we cede that responsibility, and I know you're probably having a heart attack when I say responsibility,
it's okay.
Let me change that to make it more palatable. If we cede that role,
yes,
then our, I don't want to say ideological enemies, but the people, those nations, and I'm thinking China, will somebody has to take up the role. I don't see it happening by private industries around the world, but someone has taken up the
– I disagree with that, but that's okay.
Okay, well, would you
– Yeah, we can disagree.
We can come back to that. I don't know. I'm not – this is way outside my area of expertise, so sure. I don't really know. I'm just kind of riffing and spitballing as I go along. Then the idea would be that – I mean, I'm thinking of in the East Indo-Pacific, for example, with China. The idea would be that they then – instead of Pax Americana, it would be Pax China, and they would control those waterways, and they would have access to trade, and they could cut off the supply of goods. Again, to go back to Strait of Hormuz, what is it, like 33% of natural gas, 25% of oil, something like that. So maybe I've reversed those figures. But you're then talking about the economic engines of the United States being held hostage to, I don't know if you want to call China an enemy, but at least a competitor that then controls those waterways.
Yeah. I mean,
okay, but then you undoubtedly
that's true. Well, see, this is the
you'd very, be held hostage.
I don't agree with that. The really fortunate part about being America or being an American is that we have tremendous natural resources. If we were to actually like become more self-reliant, I think that this would be a much smaller issue. And let me also add, they have immense incentive to continue to do trade with us. I mean, we are the consumer of all goods on the planet, essentially. So I honestly believe it's largely fear-mongering, and I'm not accusing you of doing so. But when people say, well, if we weren't to police these waters, then you know, why would goods get here? How could goods get here? It's like, well, because we have the money. We want to buy it. And as long as that money has purchasing power, people will continue to find ways to get their goods here. Like, that's inevitable. The reason that we're so reliant on the rest of the world to produce all these goods, though, is because of our central bank. Because we are, as the global reserve currency, our primary export is the US dollar. We don't export goods. We export paper. That is not a sustainable model.
And the only reason that that's existent in the first place is because of petrodollars, right? And because we're the world's reserve currency.
Yes.
The moment that starts to tank, we are completely fucked.
Hyperinflation.
I mean, forget the whole thing is done.
Like, exactly.
All of it, done. Done.
And for the record, Donald Trump and Joe Biden have absolutely no answer for this.
Thank you
issue.
For saying that. Thank
it's the
you
truth.
So much for saying. I want to shake your hand and hug you for saying that. No, it's infuriating to me. It's infuriating to me that the one thing that's going to cause the end of the civilization, it's not going to be homelessness or fentanyl or like, it's not going to be, I know people are going to freak out about this, but it's not going to be the environment. It's going to be the insane money printing and spending.
Yes. That will be our demise.
Nobody, it will be. And literally nobody's talking about it. It's so insane to me. Okay. But going back to something you said before, I'm going to, Reed hates it when I say this, but I'm going to give you what you're looking for.
Okay.
So I agree with you, for example, I can't remember the stat off the top of my head, but most insulin, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is produced outside of the United States.
I think that's true.
We cannot have that situation. Like, we have to have pharmaceuticals that are produced in this country. We have to have – the Taiwanese are very good at that, by the way. They are very incredibly self-reliant people, but they're still dependent on foreign oil sources. Okay. From the Middle East, largely. Mm-hmm. So – we have to have a kind of resilience with regard to, as a minimum, medical products, I would argue.
I think it's important, but I think that it would be a naturally occurring phenomenon just simply because you could not have a break in that supply chain because your customer would die. So you would have to make sure that you can't have some sort of geopolitical conflict that diminishes the supply of these life-saving medicines.
Right. Even if prices went up, and you're probably opposed to the government subsidizing that, but even if prices went up, that would not be enough to incentive. I mean, they'd have to shoot through the roof in order to kind of have the military infrastructure to support those waterways and to support the free access of goods and the supply chains.
Yeah, well, maybe. I mean, but to go back, I really have to explain this point.
No, go.
Yeah, because it's so important. The reason that we're so reliant on production all over the world as opposed to domestically, the reason our industrial,
fascinating. Area I think I know what you're going to say.
Has been hollowed out is because of the primary export being the US dollar, which artificially raises the wages of the domestic population, which makes it far more competitive for foreign workers to produce the same goods. It also makes it so that they can then produce more of the, you know, mineral goods and things that go into the, you know, the production supply. So I think that if it were not for central banking, we would not have hollowed out the industry of America. So all of the issues that Donald Trump talks about in terms of protectionist policy, in terms of putting tariffs on China and things like that, these are all band-aids on bullet wounds. But the gun that was fired was the Federal Reserve. So until people are willing to actually look at that, the inevitable economic demise that you've lamented, and I share, that is going to come to pass. You cannot get past the intractable reality that borrowing and spending more than you produce will ultimately bankrupt you. This applies to a consumer, and it will ultimately apply to a nation. The only reason that the U.S. has withstood such unbelievably moronic
$54 trillion, by the way, that's what it's at now.
Yeah, well, I think that's including some of the unfunded liabilities. I think it's $34.5 trillion. But regardless, if you include unfunded liabilities, we're over $100 trillion, and it's probably a quadrillion if you include
that. I had not heard.
Yeah, so I mean, it's over. Sorry, we got a gasp in the audience here.
I've been saying it's over, but we all know it's over.
Yeah,
so why aren't people talking about it?
No.
You don't think they're electable? No, go ahead.
No. We all don't know it's over. You and I know it's over. You know, people with any sort of economic background certainly know it's
over. But I have no economic background.
Well, then you're a smarter guy than most. I don't know. Look, I'm telling you, there are very few people that understand economics. There's very few people that understand business. This is why you have such a huge burgeoning movement of socialists in this country, is that they don't understand economics. In fact, they've been propagandized to believe that every issue that ails them is a product of capitalism, as opposed to
– Well, it's a totally deranged.
Yeah, well, it is, but they believe it deeply. Yeah. So it's like, it's very important that we don't dismiss their concerns. I think that what I attempt to do, at least, is that the real issue with, because like Marxists, for instance, they focus on power a lot. You know, they talk about the powerful. My argument from a libertarian framework, the true answer is that they don't have real power unless they're in bed with the state. The state is the one with the monopoly on violence. Private corporations don't have a monopoly on violence. So, no, sorry, you disagree?
I agree mostly, but I want to put an and in there and you tell me what you think.
Yeah.
Or an or. I'll put an or instead of an and. Or the existent institutional organizational structures like academia and legacy media. That's where they get their power.
Well, it's power, but it's influential power as opposed to force. Like the state is really the progenitor of most force on the planet. Because like McDonald's, for instance, it sells poison, but they don't force me to buy it. But Joe Biden tried to force poison into my body.
I just ate French fries yesterday at McDonald's. I haven't eaten fries in like 20 years. God, they were so good though.
It's good. It doesn't ever biodegrade.
Yeah.
But it does taste good.
So give me the Biden thing again. So Biden what now?
So for instance, Pfizer, I think, is a terrible company. Mm. Granted, they've created some products that would save lives, undoubtedly. But the reality is like they are so deeply enmeshed with the governments, not just our government, but the governments of the world, that they have become very sick. You know, sicker than their customers. They will turn towards state power to mandate the use of their products. I think it's totally reprehensible.
Okay, so what do you want to talk about?
Well, I'd like to talk about the dangers with our foreign policy.
Okay, go ahead.
This is really what, aside from the lockdowns and the COVID era, what actually compelled me to throw my hat in the ring for the VP run was our foreign policy. And this is also what made, you know, Ron Paul so great, is that he appeared to have a crystal ball. He appeared to be a psychic based off of his ability to analyze, you know, what he described as blowback, which is actually a CIA term.
Yeah.
Which is...
Bob Baer talks about that, right? It's about his book. Sorry, I don't know. Just thinking out loud. Go ahead.
No, it's okay. But, you know, Rudy Giuliani famously called Ron Paul out and tried to shame him in front of the GOP during the debates. And Ron didn't waver whatsoever. And I'm glad he didn't, because he was 100% right that our foreign interventionism ultimately creates deleterious consequences for the American people. And sometimes that amounts to a 9/11. Sometimes it amounts to decades of war that are highly avoidable, but are a byproduct of our consistent intervention abroad. This also ties into the defense of the petrodollar. I think that that's a huge underlying factor, which the American people are not privy to, as to why we topple the Saddams and the Gaddafis and the Assads and the Putins of the world, is that they think that they are the actual leaders of their country. And they quickly realize that the American empire and the US dollar machine has deemed them unfit to rule. And then we concoct some sort of, you know, nonsensical narrative, or we actually, you know, bring up some of their atrocities too, because these aren't good people necessarily either, and we justify intervention. But to make it explicit, yeah. The reason I decided to run is that I believe strongly that we are on the precipice of World War III.
With
I'm not sure. I think that it's Russia is the most pressing, undoubtedly, but China is certainly in the offing. I think Iran is. I mean, it's basically, it goes Russia, most dangerous, most imminent, Iran, third most dangerous, second most imminent, and then the CCP, which is, you know, right behind Russia in terms of danger.
Okay. So, okay. Because there's so much here. Okay. So.
And I want to see that avoided.
Right. Because you're not a lunatic. Okay.
Yes, exactly.
So,
which no one in the Biden administration can say the same. These people are out of their fucking minds. Sorry.
Okay. No, you say anything you want. Okay. So explain to me. So you've just said, and I agree, China is the most charitable thing one can say is it's a concern. It's a serious concern.
Sure.
So explain to me how the United States, in your view, under your vision, counters China's One Belt, One Road policy.
Yeah.
Well, so unpack that a little bit.
Sure. I think what China is doing is a more peaceable empire building. Like they are trying to bribe the rest of the world into becoming their friends as opposed to blowing up the rest of the world and scaring them into be their friends. It's actually kind of a Machiavellian divide. You know, would you rather be loved or feared? The American empire functions off fear. As of now, the CCP functions off of love, or at least purchased love, which is fairly shallow. So I think that the way you compete with China is not by becoming them, and it is not by starting nuclear war. At some point, the American people need to realize that the empire will end, and it's our choice if we want to see it end in nuclear hellfire or if we want to see it end and realize that we can no longer police the world. We're talking about massive nuclear powers, some with over a billion people. Like, you're not going to win a multi-front world war. I don't think you can win a single front world war with a nuclear power. I think it is truly existential. It has to be avoided. You have to negotiate. No matter how reprehensible you find Putin or Xi or any of these people, you cannot have head-to-head hot war between nuclear powers. This was an understood reality in the 1980s, and now we're just like, who cares? Let's do it anyways.
I actually really liked Obama's answer that he got crazy shit for, that he would meet directly with the – I don't know if you remember this during the debate, and his team lost their minds. He's like, nope, I mean it, that he'll meet directly with the leaders of quote-unquote enemy states.
Yes.
And I thought –
it's the only answer.
I was amazed that Trump did that in North Korea and
– when he crossed the DMZ, it was – I think it was the best moment of his presidency. I honestly
pretty
do.
Amazing. It's pretty amazing. Okay, so let me ask you a question. How likely on a scale from 1 to 10 do you think nuclear holocaust is in the next 10 years?
I mean, I have to believe it's low simply because of mutually assured destruction, and that ultimately people's desire, no matter how ideologically possessed, will ultimately boil down, hopefully, to not going that direction.
Like 2 or?
Yeah, I'd say 5%, 2%, you know, something real but low.
Yeah. So.
And I pray to God I'm right.
Yeah, well, in my case, that wouldn't help anything, but okay.
I don't really believe in God either, but I'm going to still do it.
Okay. So you think there's a low chance, and you think that our foreign policy excursions increase the likelihood of those of that occurrence?
100%.
The worst case scenario.
And let me explain too. Like, the reason I brought up Ron Paul and his incredible blowback moment is because what Victoria Nuland and the U.S. State Department did in Ukraine in not just 2014. Everybody talks about 2014 and the Maidan, but it actually was years prior to that too. Like, we have been fucking with Russia's neighbors and their government models and their politicians for decades. So if Putin or Xi were to be doing that in Mexico or Canada, which, by the way, I think that the CCP may have done that in Canada. I'm not even sure about Trudeau. Certainly seems like a plant to me, but not to get too sidetracked, if they were doing that in Mexico and trying to put in some politician that was going to realign them with their, you know, defensive block over our own, there's no way that the American, you know, military machine or the American political establishment would permit that. But we just take it on face value that, like, Putin has no right to do what we would absolutely do ourselves. And I think it's an absurdity. And I think also the consistent marching orders, the you know, rote memorized nonsense about unprovoked invasion, just they said it from day one over and over again. He could not have been more clear. In the leaked cables between Condoleezza Rice and William Burns, current CIA head who was former ambassador to Russia, he said very explicitly, this is the reddest of red lines. You cannot add Ukraine into NATO. If you do, they will invade. And Putin has been saying it consistently since the invasion. If you add Ukraine into NATO, that means we are at war with NATO. That cannot happen. And it has not shifted.
Then you have Article 5 too.
Exactly. Yeah. But this is why Putin says, then I'm at war with NATO. Because he realizes it's an immediate Article 5 trigger.
Yeah, exactly. Attack on one, attack on all.
Okay. Exactly. So this has to be avoided. It has to be de-escalated. We cannot continue to, you know, big dick our way around the planet. We're talking about a country with over 2,000 nuclear weapons. Yeah. What are we doing? It's total madness. And there was no one in the political establishment, aside from Donald Trump on occasion, and RFK to a certain extent, that will actually be honest about the peril that we're in. And the American people are sleepwalking themselves into World War III. They don't even understand how perilous this is. And during the Cold War, we all understood you could not have a hot war between nuclear powers. Now we just act as if like, well, it's inevitably going to happen. We're inevitably going to go to war with Russia. That is not inevitable, and we cannot allow that perception to persist. Yeah. It is truly existential. If you care about not just you, not just your kids, but everyone on Earth, this is like just I can't overstate how important this is. This is the entire reason that I'm willing to do this. That and the economic demise are the two most.
I don't think there's anything you can do about that. Nothing personal.
No, well, I think someone could do it if they were to be elected. I think there's
do you
nothing.
Really?
I think there's nothing I could do.
What
about
could
it.
They do?
Well, you'd have to go back to some version of sound money, and you'd have to
like implement Bretton Woods, like gold standards,
yeah,
or what?
And you'd have to implement tremendous austerity. You would have to cut spending massively. There's no political will. I agree with you, but it is not impossible. Javier Milei is doing it
they
in Argentina
would be
right now.
Thrown out. I mean, there's no. I cannot. I hope I'm wrong.
No. I think you're. I don't think I it's going to happen. Yeah. But it is not impossible. Javier Milei is doing it.
Yeah.
Like there is a chance that we have. For instance, say Jerome Powell decides to continue to hike rates in, you know, contrary to Joe Biden's demands,
right.
and he creates a deflationary bust. He goes the Volcker route. He does the right thing.
Yeah.
He creates temporary massive pain, but it buys us some time. In that time, you could absolutely implement austerity and try and go back to either a basket of hard assets to back your currency. You could do things. These are all things that are doable. This is not an inevitable conclusion. However, there is no political will, and what's most horrifying—
People aren't even talking about it, yeah.
What's most horrifying is that there isn't even the education amongst the American people to understand how dire this is.
I know.
So, and with that, you cannot create the political will. So
I know.
It's an Ouroboros, as you said
last night. Okay, so I'm going to totally change topics.
Sure.
I'm using these conversations as a way to flesh out my own ideas and get different perspectives for people. So one thing that I've noticed, again, changing topics, one thing that I've noticed is that the United States is a big country. Florida is bigger than England, for example. It's a big country. And when I go around the country, when I go around the world, one of the things that I've noticed is how radically different LA is, for example, from Naples, just as to throw out two, because two places just was. So in LA, for example, people are committing social justice on the sidewalk. There's a – I'm glad you like that. You got that now. Good. That's good. There are armed security guards in the Dunkin' Donuts, in the CVS, you know, the fentanyline. My buddy Brandon Boyd from Incubus was talking about that. People, you know, leaning like this. Homelessness, tents, et cetera. Then you go to Naples. It's a different world.
Yeah.
It's a completely different world. So I have two questions for you.
Sure.
My first question is – why doesn't a mayor like Ted Wheeler from Portland, he, him, his, by the way, why doesn't he think, okay, I think I know the answer to this, but I'm not sure.
Sure.
Like, oh, you know, Naples is clean. They're not destroying the police department. Nobody's committing social justice on the sidewalk. There are no tents. There's no fentanylines. There are no zombies downtown. The windows aren't boarded up. What are they doing that I'm not doing? Like, what can we do to adopt that to we can have a more sane civil society without deranged people running around doing crazy shit all the time? Okay, so that's my first question to you. Why don't the mayors of those cities like Seattle, like LA, why don't they just look at the places that have functioning societies and figure out what they're doing and do it? That's my first question to you.
Yeah, well— first and foremost, because I don't think that our electoral system is very legitimate. So I think that needs to be addressed. But I also think that their donors, they're not interested in having them go that route. So like the real reason that you get elected, assuming that the electoral system is fair, well, it's still broken because it's being funded by private interests to the tune of, you know, 90% of whatever their fundraising is. So they get to instruct their policy.
And that's not true in Naples. I am just plucking Naples out of the air.
I have no idea, to be honest, about Naples.
Okay.
But So that those are two aspects, but I think the third and the more nefarious aspect or the more hidden aspect is that these people are really ideologically possessed.
Absolutely. Yeah. They are completely all in.
Yeah. They don't believe in property rights.
Right. So they don't – is it – okay. So like Ted Wheeler, is it that he – I cannot fathom that he wants a society like this, like that he wants cars to be broken to. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. Maybe – I have no idea what the guy does. Or,
yeah. I can't know his heart either. But the reality is that as soon as you get away from property rights, this is why I believe in libertarianism, anarcho-capitalism, whatever you want to call it, or just the foundational American doctrine that like property rights are very – they're paramount. They're very important. You cannot have a functioning civilization if you don't honor property rights.
Yeah. P.J. O'Rourke writes about that in that great little funny book, Eat the Rich. And people have written about that for years, but he makes that he makes that accessible to people.
They don't enforce property rights when it comes to shoplifting. They don't enforce property
that's
rights
true, yeah.
when it comes to the homelessness crisis because of the commons. Like these are property rights issues. They're masquerading as mental health and all these other issues. And those are all real issues too. But like because the real – and in my opinion, the only real moral kind of foundational use of the state is to uphold and defend property rights. If the state doesn't do that, well, then what are you existing for?
Okay, I'm gonna ask you my second question, but just tell you something. This guy I do jiu-jitsu with is a cop. He's a brown belt in jiu-jitsu. And I was asking him, what percentage of crimes are committed by homeless people, like petty crimes? He said, that's the wrong question to ask. The right question to ask is, what percentage of homeless people commit petty crimes? Mm. And he said 100%.
Hmm. Oh, because
I'm just throwing that out there. But that gets back to the relationship between homelessness, property crime, private property. So let's say that you the libertarians win. You're the vice president of the United States. The president has a meeting, all the advisors, and he's like, look, the whole West Coast is a big shithole. We need to figure this out. We need to clean this up. We simply cannot. This is just un-American. It's just a public disgrace. We're not going to go into the reasons. We already did. What do you advise the president to do as the libertarian president?
Well, this is going to be probably a very unpopular opinion, but I am not interested in dictating to every state what they're to do. I am a big 10th Amendment guy, or 9th for that matter. I just think that the states have to have autonomy. And if they don't have autonomy, then why do we even have 50 different states? Like they have to be able to deal with these issues how they see fit. Now, the unfortunate reality, and I got into an argument with Tim Pool about this, he was saying, Clint, it sounds like you're just willing to retreat constantly. It's like, no. I'm not. I will put my feet in the ground at some point, but I will only do so in winning battles. Like he was the reason we got into this fight is he was talking about New York and how it was decaying, or California for that matter.
Yeah,
and totally. Like to a certain extent, these people want these policies. This is.
Oh no, they absolutely want the policies. They arrested Jordan Neely for
exactly.
I mean, they want these. So we agree on that. But
Tim was basically, without saying so, he was kind of advocating for federal intervention, which would amount to war. And I'm not interested in going that route.
Hold on a second. So I just want to make sure that we're on the same page. So we both agree that they want the policies. Is it that they don't connect the policies to the consequences?
To the outcome? I don't know.
So let me
– I don't know how you could – like. Okay. And the reason I say I don't know is because I – grew up and lived in California, and I watched the decay, and I watched people like Gavin Newsom was recalled in 2021, I think it was. Yeah. And this was like after he had completely destroyed our way of life, and he won his recall election by 70%.
Yeah, I know why he ran. I know.
If you could tell me,
I'll
I would love to
know.
I'll
tell you off camera why he won. I know the people who I thought Larry Elder had his chance. And that was the one I think Schellenberger was in that one, right?
Yeah, I think so. It was the most heartbreaking, you know, thing of my life.
Okay, so let's
it was just
okay,
the state I loved, destroyed by this man, wins 70%. It's crazy.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go back to this because I'm struggling. I'm legitimately struggling to understand this. Yes, they want the policies. Yes, they voted for the policies. And I ask you this again, but I really am legitimately trying to understand this. Is it that they don't understand the policies are linked to consequences? Let me give you an example. I'm hesitant about saying this because someone told me this in confidence, but I have a friend of mine – well, friend is too strong. I have an acquaintance of mine who was telling me she was harassed by this guy in New York. She was texting me. And she said he was following her on the street, and she didn't know what to do. So she approached two vendors. You know, they had – I didn't ask what stand or whatever. But and she said, you know, will you please help me? Mm-hmm. And they looked at her, and they looked at the guy, and the guy was from a diverse background. Let's put it like that.
Sure.
And they looked at her, and they looked at each other, and they said no. And then she became – they were men. She's a woman, mm-hmm. a NATO woman, just in case anybody's curious. So she started walking down, and the guy was super, super aggressive. And then she started running. He followed her. He tackled her. He ripped the necklace off of her and started hitting her in the head, and then wow. went away. Like, he didn't rape her or murder or anything like yeah. that. But she was completely freaked out by it, like, complete because she asked someone for help. So I don't know if this is related to Jordan Neely. Like, I don't know if this – and the context of that was the guy in the subway who basically had this long history of violence, et cetera, was threatening people.
Jordan Neely throws him a chokehold and
yeah, he's white. Yeah. The guy was black. The other people who were passengers, I believe the two of those guys who tried to restrain the guy were also black. So – and then the guy died. He was struggling.
Right.
And – now
it has to have a knock-on effect.
Well, it has to,
because, like, as a man who would defend women, if I was in New York, I would not defend women.
That's the thing that I've been thinking about. Like, what would I do now? Would I want to risk going to prison, especially if the man was of a diverse background?
Yeah.
Then you'd be like,
I'm just being honest. Like, I would if it was a loved one, of course, you're going to always defend them. But if it's a stranger, yeah. I'm not going to risk my freedom.
Okay. So my question to you is then. Is it that people don't realize the consequences of attempting to indict Jordan Neely? Is it that they don't realize that those behaviors have direct consequences? Is that what it is? This is not exactly extending a hermeneutic of charity. Is it that they want women to be punched in the head because they want to show that the system is broken and you have to overthrow all of capitalism? Is that what they're thinking?
There are certain aspects of the, you know, the Marxist revolutionary mindset that it's like the revolution is continual and we will destroy – you must destroy what is to see what comes next. If you listen to Kamala Harris, despite the fact that she sounds like a bumbling moron –
I cannot stand – she is a brainless nincompoop.
Yes. Yes, she is. But if you listen to her in the morass of nonsensical words she's throwing at you, you will actually hear like a vein of Marxist thought. It's like, I can't really give a good example, but if people listen to her speeches –
the equity thing is a great example.
Yeah, well, they talk about that a lot, but they also like – we have to destroy what's – or not – she doesn't say destroy. It's always like it's toned down, but if you were to just amp up the rhetoric slightly, it would sound a lot like a Marxist revolutionary. It's very interesting. But the point I wanted to get to is that I think that there is – amongst the people that vote Democrat in particular, and this is going to upset a lot of people, but I don't care because I think it's true. They are awash in guilt. They have been
white guilt or what kind of guilt? Economic
white guilt, economic wealth guilt, whatever it
guilt.
Is, privilege, all of it, because they have so deeply imbibed of the critical theory nonsense, and they genuinely perceive themselves to be oppressors. So they like when they suffer, there is some sort of self-flagellation that's happening, I honestly think that they feel like they deserve it.
Okay, so you're then making that as an argument for what the people are thinking for why they let homelessness run rampant, because they think somehow deep down it's their fault and this is the compassionate thing, or they think this is a way to get back at themselves. Like
if their life is more challenging,
yeah.
I think it makes them feel better because they feel as if they deserve to not have as good a life as they have.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does.
I mean, it's not necessarily rational, but
so is it the reason that people feel that, for example, in San Francisco? I almost said San Francisco. Is the reason that people feel that there and not in, I don't know, for example, Naples, I don't know. It's, again, nothing special about Naples, but or Jacksonville or Dallas. Is the reason that people feel that there because they moved there because they had these liberal sensibilities and impulses in the first place, and then that's just a vestige of whatever kind of ideological baggage they had with them, and then it manifests itself in terms of self-guilt?
Yeah. I mean, I think that these people are – they're ideologues, but many of them don't even know it. They don't even like understand how deeply they have drank of this poison, especially if you go to – you know, if you go through 4 years of college after going through 12 years of public school, like you are – basically an automaton. You've been brainwashed, completely brainwashed. So even though your own belief system has destroyed your current city and your current existence, when you traverse to the next new place that isn't destroyed, you destroy it nonetheless.
So I need to explain what you just said because it's so important and literally nobody is talking about it. Well, almost nobody. James Lindsay's talking about it. So the idea is that K through 12 systems have become indoctrination mills, and they've become indoctrination mills because in order to get a teaching certificate, you have to go through college of education. They've imbibed the ideology, and then we have the entire academic system. The entire infrastructure has become ideologically corrupt. And then you listen to certain media outlets that share that corruption. Like I would argue, we may have a disagreement about this, but I would argue chief among those is NPR. Sure. It is a chief purveyor of cultural nonsense and utter poison in identitarian insanity. Okay, so the reason then that Wesk we're hypothesizing because they would never come on camera to talk to us because they don't believe in dialogue, which is the other thing that was running through my mind. I was going to ask, are the progressives in the Libertarian Party also unwilling to have conversations? But bracket that. We'll come back to that later. So the reason that Ted Wheeler, for example, looks at this and doesn't want to fix it is gun deaths among African Americans. He doesn't want to be seen as a racist if he tries to fix that problem, or whatever interventions would mean placing police in minority neighborhoods, which could then be seen as racist, or whatever kind of thinking. Is the reason that he just doesn't connect the policies to the consequences of the policies?
I don't. So this is my honest opinion, and I don't know Ted Wheeler, so I can't know for sure. But
he, him, his
retarded. I think that. Sorry, you may have to bleep that. So the story I always go back to is Chernobyl. Yeah. There is an unwillingness. Like once you're in kind of a communistic system, there is an unwillingness to tell the truth up and down the chain of command. So I think that's what we're witnessing. Is that like, for instance, like you, as you pointed out, there's massive issues with gun crime amongst the black community, and particularly in cities.
If you talk about that, you're a racist.
You're a racist automatically. But the mayors in particular in those cities, they will not talk about it. And in fact, they will just lie through their teeth. They will say like crime, violent crime is down. And like they do this with San Francisco, even though San Francisco is literally like disappearing before our very eyes, you will have them just lie through their teeth and say, well, year over year, this is down and this is down and this is down, despite the fact that they're manipulating statistics from the height of the pandemic to today, or they're just not enforcing these crimes. So then the numbers go down and then they say, we're doing great, and they do a victory lap. So my point is, like during Chernobyl, you had these generals that wouldn't tell the truth about the severity of the situation. As a consequence, a hell of a lot of people died. So I think a lot of these people, they're cowards. They want to protect their little throne, their little, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. That's microscopic piece of power.
That's
so they
why,
just,
by the
they
way,
bite their tongue.
The mafia has the consigliere, somebody who'll tell the Don the truth no matter what.
Exactly. Very important to have that guy.
Yeah. Real quick, is there anything I should have asked you that I didn't ask you?
I would have loved to get into the ESG DEI stuff. I've been very inspired by James' work, but I've also been covering that on my show, Liberty Lockdown, for the past few years. I think it's one of the most underreported stories in terms of how the ideology of academia found its way into corporate America.
Love to talk about that. Became so pervasive. Can't do it now in 30 seconds.
No, of course.
Anything else? I'm just saying
that would be an important aspect of my campaign because people do not understand that the DEI framework in particular, its origination comes from the Barack Obama administration, an executive order in August of 2011 that mandated that all federal departments across the government implement DEI. As a consequence, all contractors, any Fortune 500, any major corporation that does business with the federal government also had to implement DEI. So this entire DEI ESG stuff – stems from the UN and the Barack Obama administration. For people to pretend as if it's a naturally occurring phenomenon, it's just a lie. Libertarians need to stop turning a blind eye towards it. And this is my opportunity to chastise them for pretending like it's just, well, this is what people believe.
Yeah, I would ask you if you have any questions for me, but we're at a hard stop. I know. Clint, thanks so much. Where can people find you?
At Liberty Lockpod on X. Liberty Lockdown is the show on YouTube and Rumble. Or all audio podcatchers. And then I also do the best political show over on We Are Change with Luke Radowski and Steph. Really huge pleasure. Big fan of your work and cool, James thanks. As well. So thank you again.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it. Thanks for coming on the show. Thanks. Thank you for watching. Everything we do is under the umbrella of the National Progress Alliance, nationalprogressalliance.org. It's a nonprofit, independent 501c3. Your generous donations keep us going and keep fueling content like this. So please help us out. Make a donation. We very much appreciate it. Thank you.